Hello, and welcome to The World View. The debates around innovation policy take up a lot of oxygen in DC, but the world is big. Join me, Katie Mitchell, a DC insider on the outside, as I shine a light on the bright spots of innovation policy and offer some takeaways for the debate back home. You may know it for its sandy beaches, flat whites, meat pies, and fabulous wine, and you'd be right. But Australia is one of the leading markets in global crypto adoption too. Today, we're heading down under to catch up with Steve Vallis, founder and head of Blockchain APAC and former head of Blockchain Australia, for an overview of what's happening in the market today, particularly around policy. If you're in the crypto space in Australia, you know Steve. And if you don't know Steve, you should. The TLDR, before we get started, there's a lot of work to do, but no more exciting time to do it. That's all here today on The World View. Well, welcome, Steve, to The World View. Very apropos because you've had a bird's eye view of the world with all of your travels to the U.S. And we were just catching up on Steve's agenda for the coming weeks. So we'll cover that later on and talk about his forthcoming adventures across Asia and Europe. But today we're going to focus on Australia, where Steve has finally landed and is home. And we're really honored and lucky to have you. So thank you so much, Steve.
Really happy to be part of this recording.
Awesome. So I wanted to start out by just laying the groundwork of the broader crypto sentiment in Australia before we get into policy. And, you know, something that I've thought about is why crypto is so popular in Australia. There's a theory that Web3 or crypto tends to be a little bit more popular where there's an acute economic inefficiency to solve. And I'm thinking inflation in Turkey or Argentina, but Australia has a fairly digitized financial system, and there are a lot of fintechs that are driving further efficiencies across the market. It has the national payments platform, which is still striving to gain traction, but still there's a lot of momentum digitally, so to speak. So why do you think crypto is so compelling and frankly popular in Australia?
I think there's the serious answer that sort of relates to macro conditions that probably make it a subject matter people at least have some degree of interest in. And then there is a cultural element as well. They couldn't be further removed, Katie. One is things like assets and the value of assets in Australia and the ability to join things like the property ladder. Property is very expensive in Australia. The Australian dream is to own a home. And at this point in time, fewer and fewer people, if they don't really have a home in the family, are likely to own them. So I think people want to know what they can do to elevate themselves from that perspective. So that's a structural conversation, I think, which draws some interest. At the other end, culturally, Australians like to gamble. The reality here is they don't mind speculation. So I think the convergence of these things, which is how do you accumulate assets, and a societal bent, which is sadly true, lots of poker machines, lots of gambling per head, people think speculation is not a terrible thing. So that's not necessarily a great combination of factors, but I think that plays in a little bit to why the psychology of the space has been of interest to people.
Yeah, not risk averse, I think, is, and I've just seen, I mean, it's interesting when I've worked and consulted with fintechs, and one of the first ports of international expansion has often been Australia. And I think it's because of just this appetite for adoption that tends to permeate across the market. And it's a reason why I'm such a fan of working on issues related to Australia, aside from the good coffee that I get when I'm able to travel down there. And another element is you started Blockchain Australia before now founding and leading Blockchain APAC. What do you see within the Australian market as opportunities for innovators themselves? What do you think is a feature or factor that makes Australia so compelling to start a crypto business? And what are some of the unique challenges to the market?
Things have changed a lot with respect to how the space has been sort of perceived. one of the counters to what I'd started with, which is sort of the cultural element that creates interest, particularly on the retail side of crypto, is in some respects tempered by the fact it's pretty conservative from a mature business perspective. You know, we have, as you pointed out, a pretty mature payments sort of framework and infrastructure. We have a small number of banks. Those businesses don't tend to move too quickly. So it does leave a gap where people want to create businesses. So the startup mentality is pretty strong. And Australians like to test themselves relative to their global peers. So there's a can-do kind of attitude there. So there's a willingness to do these things. Again, these are intersecting factors, Katie. One of the challenges, of course, is capital. You know, we like to build things. One of the challenges in the space is people think they can play a part. The issue is if you do build something, can you stay in Australia or do you have to sort of move on? So that's one of the things that's been shaping where resources have gone in the space. And early on, before all the negative sentiment had kicked in about crypto and the implications for retail and consumer protections, it was a thriving ecosystem in that regard. That's kind of ebbed and flowed according to the narratives that have been attached to this subject matter. And it's fair to say, I think, in the current environment, people are more skittish than they probably were 12 to 18 months ago, which is problematic because now is, as we all know, in these kind of conditions, it's a good time to build. So it's great. Right. We're hoping these things don't go in opposite directions.
Yeah, and I that's an interesting kind of transition then to the policy environment, because I would assume, and we've seen this in lots of jurisdictions, that sentiment similarly has changed and shifted because of events of last year and some of the mistrust in the ecosystem based on some of the more nefarious players that unfortunately disrupted a lot of the good work that was going on. The kind of along that moment where we had a little bit of a bull market, so to speak, and also a broader kind of positive momentum around the industry, we also had a different government in Australia, and that government seemed to have a fairly bullish approach in terms of setting out regulatory clarity for crypto. Now that we've shifted governments and then compounded by the fact that there has been this sea change of sentiment, have you seen a significant deviation between governments and their approach to regulation? Or what would you say marks the transition there for folks to be aware of?
I can say, having engaged a reasonable amount with the previous government, there was interest and some noise, but it didn't go deep. I mean, the reality of this space is it continues to be a one-on-one and an onboarding exercise for individual politicians. So notwithstanding the fact there was some interest and visibility, it was never anything that the former government really embraced in any meaningful way. But what happens, of course, when any government talks about this subject matter, Katie, wherever it is in the world, everyone jumps on it. I mean, everyone gets so excited that someone's speaking about it, that in some respects it amplifies what's happening, and it probably gives too much credit for what's happening. And we all do it. We all peer over the fence, assuming the grass is greener, and I often joke it's not grass, it's concrete, and it's green, but it's grass from a distance. So that sentiment was not deeply rooted enough, and I think what we've found is a very material change in economic conditions is preoccupying the new government, as you would expect. You know, issues of inflation and macro sort of headwinds and all sorts of supply chain breakdowns and defence spending, very hard then in that context to say where are we at with digital assets. So it's kind of that reset is a natural reset with a new government. And I think a lot of jurisdictions are finding, particularly given that the previous government was in for multiple terms, there are lots of people who wait their turn for a new government. And so lots of voices will come simultaneously. So I don't think there's that much of a difference. It's probably been perceived to be much more than it actually is. They're just trying to prioritise what are lots of concerns now from an Australian perspective. So it's a reboot, Katie. The truth is these conversations start again and people move on. And you start the conversation. So there should be an expectation that roll up the sleeves and start that conversation again with someone new.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, it's reassuring, although that probably feels almost Sisyphean for folks on the ground to have to continue to educate and almost start afresh. But I'm often reassured. In last podcast, we talked about MiCA in Europe, and it does seem that outside of the US, there isn't this hyper polarization or politicization that we're starting to see calcify back in the States. And that, I think, is cause for optimism. So when there isn't a significant shift, whenever there's a change of power, I think that's always good for industry. We don't have to deal with the a completely different sentiment around crypto broadly. So that's positive. One thing that we've been following and working on is what is progressing within government. And obviously, there was this token mapping exercise. Token taxonomy has been part of the European approach to regulation folded into MiCA. It's a fixture feature in the UK as well. What's your prognosis for policymaking at Treasury, considering their need to respond to industry's responses to the token mapping exercise? And then what do you see as kind of the next frontier for us to engage?
Sure. There are three parts to that answer. The first part is the token mapping was the right decision at the time. When it was adopted as something that was a priority, it was pre-FTX, it was pre-Luna. There was greater optimism, I think, and confidence that we could move forward and categorize things. And it really put some time into it. The change in sentiment and the change in conditions of the market, I think, made it very difficult for what was the plan to be executed against. And ultimately, the token mapping exercise has come out, and it's a very interesting document, and it speaks to the thinking of Treasury. But I think it's probably a little bit short of the mark where people expected it would land. You know, people expected to be told, here's what the product is, here's how it's characterized, here's what it means. It was never going to do that. But I think it's in much more difficult conditions they find themselves delivering that document. So I think it was right, and it came out. And the question has moved then to how do we deal with enforcement priorities? Because much like the US, more visibly, I should say, with the SEC in particular, that enforcement bent, the world knows about it. We can't help but hear about it all the time. There's more emphasis on enforcement, and our own primary regulator, ASIC, are giving more consideration and are saying publicly enforcement is a priority and we'll definitely move forward and be more active in pursuing bad actors. That acts as a dampener to conversation. So those two things have gone in an opposite direction. What it leaves is where Treasury's focus is, I think, going forward, which is custody. And I personally, I think it's a great topic because industry participants don't disagree there is a custody framework that's required. And it's complicated because the questions that come out of a custody framework conversation is who is it to apply to and with respect to what kind of product. So there's going to be a very measured process, I think, here over the next 3 to 6 months. That considers all the key stakeholders, what their views are. But ultimately, I think we'll get a framework that will give confidence to the ecosystem. But as usual in this space, it won't feel like it's moving fast enough. But as you're aware, Katie, we have many regulators in Australia. It used to make sense. You've got all these regulators with all these discrete responsibilities. But in a world of data packets moving around at the fastest velocity they ever have and all sorts of products that weren't envisaged, that creates even more complexity. So custody will be the main focus, will be my view.
Yeah, that's fair. I mean, that was something that when I was back in payments, I remember reflecting on some of the work that Scott Farrell, the godfather of payments regulation and policy in Australia. I don't know if he likes that title, but I've dubbed it. One of the more recent reports that he had actually spoke to that there isn't this very clean matrix of responsibility to activity or actor because of where innovation is. And I think no better example of that than digital assets and the broader Web3 ecosystem, which is going to cause even more potential for overlap or kind of similar responsibilities across different regulators. So I think just as important as token mapping and that taxonomy is that clarity around oversight is similarly crucial for markets like the US and perhaps even for Australia.
Katie, I concur with the godfather moniker. I think he also doesn't like the doctor, Scott Farrell, but he's a doctor nowadays as well. What you've just pointed out is kind of a regulatory and legal geek out for me because the paper that he prepared from a payments perspective was really, really important and most people missed it. Read that document and people should go back and have a look at it. It talks about payments and then at the end of that document about what the payment system will look like if we move forward and build a fit-for-purpose current version, it says, by the way, here are some things. The last chapter's a ripper. It says here are some things that will impact the decisions about everything that's come before in this document. And it is digital asset space. It speaks to securities, crypto assets, digital. It kind of says this technology changes all the decisions, which is why I've always been empathetic when it comes to the position that the Treasury finds themselves, because I've said to them, you can fix for today's problems and be accused of not being forward-thinking, or you can fix for future problems and be accused of ignoring what's happened today. So on that basis, I've said to them each time, good luck, because I wouldn't envy the task that is merging those two challenges.
Yeah, absolutely. One thing, before we move on to kind of where Australia sits in a global context, you referenced this tendency that we're seeing in the US towards enforcement. Given where the US is, I wonder if we can almost use Australia as a time machine, and if we had the opportunity to go back in time and avoid that impasse, and perhaps do so in Australia. Do you think the key is industry engagement with the likes of ASIC? Is it further regulatory clarity from Treasury? What can we do collectively to avoid a situation in which the two sides seem to be talking against each other?
So with the benefit of the Wayback Machine, the industry challenge and a lot of people, and I have to say I had this view as well, Katie, when you talk about the subject matter, those who know it and like it and love it think it's so obvious that it's a direction we should be going in. So you tend to talk at people.
And yeah.
That was problematic. You know, the desire to say, well, of course you should think what I think. Let's go forward together. We've all suffered from that. You know, it's great. It changes everything. Come with. That was naive. And it's sort of reflected now in the way people have, I think, formed views that they haven't retreated from. On the government side, and this was something I used to put to a variety of regulators, it was just resourcing. The truth is no one understood, or few people, I should say, understood the complexity and the implications of this. So when I was formerly at Blockchain Australia, I remember saying to a very material and significant room of regulators, I can see this coming. This is a tsunami of implications and interest. And it just wasn't perceived that way. It was perceived as one of a lot of priorities, and the bit that was lost was the intersection of this technology on so many elements of what they were doing. So we went from a subject matter, and have a clear recollection of the first meeting I attended where the subject matter of stablecoins was raised as the novelty, you know, bring your children to work day topic. Look at this curiosity that is stablecoins. And by the time I had the last meeting, every single topic involved digital assets one way or another, whether it was scam narratives or digital wallets or talking about the characterization, it just was from nowhere, pervasive. And that's a resourcing exercise. And I think that's why now, watching jurisdictions other than Australia as well, you have to resource in a meaningful way and probably have to over-index on the resourcing just to play catch-up. And that's something that's very difficult for people to prioritise, because you get shouted down. People say, well, why would you give more money to this thing that many people continue to believe is a nullity or a scam or a Ponzi? Why would you do it? So there's resistance even then in the resourcing of these kinds of questions.
Yeah, that makes sense. One thing I wanted to kind of pump your tires on, Steve, is I know that there's a big event coming to Australia in July, and not just the Women's World Cup, but I know that you're working on an exciting conference. And I wondered, what role do those types of events play in just raising the opportunity for industry to share what they're doing? Because you mentioned this is a good opportunity to build. And I think there was a lot of hype. There were a lot of events kind of during the glory days of early 2022 and 2021. But now probably is the time to really showcase utility more than ever. So I wondered if you could talk a little bit about what you're working on in Australia and what role that platform will play towards that constructive dialogue with government.
Sure. I think the event topic generally, there are three things you tend to optimize for. Profit. Some events will optimize for profit, as they should. Some will optimize for attention, and others will optimize for impact. You can't have them all. And invariably, you compromise all of them by pursuing one or other. So this event, I've run a wide variety of things over the last 5 or 6 years. I choose one generally that is right for the conversation and the tone. So with this thing that we're planning, it's impact at the moment, Katie. The reality is that the quality of the conversation needs to be sort of made obvious to people who are peering into these rooms. So I'm curating within an inch of its life as many of the most influential people as I can find and the domain experts as I can find, just bringing them together. So it's not the big box event that seeks to have 1,000 people in one room. I'll have 1,000 people, but I'll split them over 20 rooms over multiple days. So there's all sorts of complexity in doing that, but I think it's more fruitful in terms of the quality of the conversation that comes out of it. So that's a tricky thing for people running events. And for the most part, I've been good at getting attention when we need to. And when it comes to marketers, Katie, I have a long history with marketers. Their KPIs are invariably set to eyeballs. So you do need to satisfy the requirement that says, why are we spending this money? And is it a good use of money? And then the question is, can you do that and at the same time have a material impact on the nature of the conversation? So because we're doing this not as an event company and it's driven by thematically important topics, we've just said we're definitely pushing to make sure it's the right conversation in this market and with an understanding of what's happening sort of regionally. So that's kind of the grand plan that sounds crazy most times I say it out loud.
So it's titled the Digital Assets Conference, right? And is 25th, 26th of July, is that correct? So you can swing down and catch some World Cup matches if you're so lucky to get a ticket. Not saying that's my plan, but maybe. on the topic of events, you were traveling, as we alluded to earlier, for some conferences, but also meetings. And I'm really curious what your takeaways were having visited the U.S. And if there are any really notable contrasts between the state of play in Australia versus back in the United States?
Well, the US is the big dog. The reality is whatever the US does, everyone pays attention and notices, except the US. The US only notices the US. So we've got that dilemma, which has always been the case. And I think most people recognize it's such a big market and such an important market, very hard to care really what's happening in other jurisdictions. So invariably the focus is the complexity of the market itself. I was reminded of that having gone over there. So then when we start talking about this subject matter in a global sense and with the lens that is what are other jurisdictions doing, the natural one to pop up are other big markets and jurisdictions. So the EU and what's happening with MiCA was a primary sort of conversation. Markets like London and the UK, because of traditionally financial service hubs, and then it becomes, you know, a cascading downhill conversation about where else in the world. So people talk about APAC, Singapore is the go-to conversation. Before Australia gets mentioned, Singapore gets mentioned. And I think that's largely a reputation built over a long period of time that is a jurisdiction that has to get things right in a financial services sense to maintain its relevance. It's a small country with a small population. So they really need to be able to build things that outperform what bigger and more resourced countries otherwise do. So it's kind of connecting those two dots. So that was one of the lenses that was affirmed for me. The other thing that was interesting on the ground was, notwithstanding the fact that all the chatter and the noise around the SEC was absolutely as we see it, there was also more resistance. And I think, you know, in smaller markets, it's often the case that there's not as much appetite. We're not as punchy when it comes to regulators. Like, everyone's so worried about saying the wrong thing, they tend to say nothing. In the US, at close quarters, I observed people were willing to push back more. So there was more natural sort of and competitive and economic tension than I expected to see, because the headlines only suggested there's one direction here, and it's all regulation by enforcement. I had the sense that people were fighting a fight, which was interesting to see. And the other thing was the general conversation about the US missing out. I don't think the US misses out. I think what happens is they kind of just press pause or they go slow. It's too big a market to leave. So it was interesting there with that sort of perspective to hear people talking about the Caymans again or Bermuda, or it was what's happening in Hong Kong of relevance, or what do we do about Dubai? So it's kind of, what do we do whilst the main show isn't on? We don't have the NFL, we don't have the gridiron going, we don't have the Super Bowl. What sport do you want to play whilst we're not playing this sport that is our own? So that was
interesting.
The view that I took out of the US.
Yeah, that's a really good way of casting it, because it almost seems like, and of course, I think this is the interesting dilemma of our peers in our industry, is that we actually, I think, give a lot of credence to headlines. A lot of information's digested on Twitter. We'll see if that sustains, or maybe a new platform emerges where folks really get their quick fixes of information. But then it's a self-fulfilling cycle where these new and disruptive outlets are also trying to kind of garner the attention of industry and have really punchy headlines. And so this whole everyone's leaving the US and it's going to be, it's going to completely lose the fight. I'm a bit more optimistic as you just framed, but I do think it's important to recognize the international opportunity and also to kind of take lessons and learnings from what other jurisdictions are doing constructively. So I tend to look glass half full at all scenarios or try to stay optimistic. And I really like the way that you framed the perhaps slight deviation or diversion of attention from the US to other jurisdictions. Doesn't mean that won't return at some juncture in terms of investment.
I think, and that's the opportunity for me. I said, if you sit and wait for the US to get it right, you just lose because the US, it's not apples with apples and oranges with oranges. It's just too big a market. And there's too much incentive for money to flow in when things are half right. So that's why I've spoken to a lot of opportunities in the APAC region, which is if you want to do a bit of a me too there, you're just consigning yourself to being an afterthought. And there's an opportunity to say, can you build out a compelling and deep enough roots in this industry that you have your bit carved out? Because you're never going to carve out the US market's bit, but you know, can you carve out your own sort of section there? And that's a more pressing and I think a more relevant conversation. Once people get that, they kind of go, oh, okay, I get it. But the natural world order in some respects will continue to play out, particularly when it comes to capital inflows and outflows. So interesting to see whether people will take that opportunity.
Yeah, and you sort of prompted one of the questions that I had, which is whether the U.S. is, I'm not going to couch it as a failure, but let's say slow start or reluctance to really pull ahead in terms of creating that regulatory clarity is either Australia or other international markets opportunities, or do you think it could conversely actually inspire lawmakers to similarly proceed with caution?
I'm a big fan of people being incentivized by their personal interests, Katie. I think the reality here is it's one thing to say here's our position, but you always frame it from what's everyone else's position. When people do genuinely believe they're missing out, they tend to move. And so I think you've got that economic incentive. And that's one of the things I like about this space and why for many years I've said it's not where you perceive it to be. It's not going anywhere. And the reality is you'll find a home and it might become a smaller home in periods of time, but it's not going anywhere. So then the question becomes, well, what's the incentive to skip the queue? And when you have conversations around jurisdictions and countries like El Salvador, it says, well, this is just silly. Why would they do it? Well, if you're otherwise consigned to being at the bottom of an economic sort of a conversation, you know, well, why wouldn't you try something that might move you through? And it might be the case that it's a political ploy. You know, we get the IMF's attention or something. There might be some other reasons at play, but you're incentivized to agitate. And I think that's not something the US generally feels like it has to do. And on the regulatory side, I think the notion that there was a somber tone, it's fair to say it was a somber tone in New York in particular, but it was also a somber tone couched with effectively the sentiment that this too shall pass. You know, Gary won't be around forever. And we don't know what the SEC does post Gary Gensler, but there will be post Gary Gensler. So people were, you know, they were comfortable enough to say, listen, we don't like the direction it's going in. And it might continue on, but Gary will move, and then we'll see whether there's a conversation that can be restarted. So I think there was that optimism there as well, that it's not ideal at the moment, and it probably will cost in the short term at a minimum economic opportunities, but we might get a do-over. So I think that sentiment sort of flowed through.
Yeah. Back to our part of the world before we close out. I've seen in a lot of my work in payments and data policy, Australia look to closely align with some of its global counterparts. So I'm thinking like open data policy and how open data in Australia is pretty similar to some of the approaches in Europe or even Singapore, UK as well. How do you see Australia fitting into the global picture with respect to crypto policy? Are there certain jurisdictions that you would anticipate the Treasury to work particularly closely with or seek alignment with? And all of that's to say there are tons of meetings coming up around global coordination. And I'm really curious if we can crystal ball how Australia is going to position itself in that alignment picture.
So I'm good at predicting the future, Katie, because I'll just look to the past and expect it'll happen. Because I think it likely will.
Yeah.
The UK approach is often the Australian approach, and that's largely because we have a similar legal system. So
right.
Very hard to otherwise incorporate what happens in jurisdictions that don't feel familiar. There is a body of law that feels familiar, the activities and what's come over many, many years, it's familiar. So I expect we will orient towards the UK approach with significant influence of what happens out of MECA and the EU, because notwithstanding the fact it's a different regime across, you know, a large number of countries, there is conservatism that comes out of the EU that we saw in things like the GDPR, and as much consternation that there might have been in the US about it, for everyone else, it kind of became the global standard. It made its way into Australia as well. So those two jurisdictions, I think, ultimately are where Australia is much more likely to land. We won't chase Singapore down. You know, I say this openly. The reality is people like to say, you know, there's this natural competition. Singapore is incentivized differently to what Australia is. So I think Singapore will continue to be sort of a regional leader in these kinds of conversations. So where are we likely to be aligned? Much more, I would say, I'd guess the UK before I guessed anyone else.
Yeah, and that's so interesting because we were talking a little bit about like sequencing and timing, and it seems as though perhaps it's not a bad thing. I'll be a little bit provocative here, that the UK gets a bit ahead. I mean, unless Australia is really keen to preempt whatever the UK does and take that kind of leading role, if they're working in a similar clip, and maybe the UK has a little bit of an edge with the HM Treasury's consultation, that will provide a bit of a roadmap for Australia Treasury to then pick up a little bit more momentum.
I'd be shocked if we leapfrog them. I think the reason here is as a jurisdiction, there will be lots of similarities. It takes a particularly brave person, and then you go back and say, well, is there a political appetite or an economic incentive? I don't see that existing at the moment. So I think in those circumstances, I think a tighter alignment is much more probable. The concern that I have that potentially is emergent is when you talk about enforcement priorities, it's not the case that they can't coexist, but they tend to happen in very different rooms. So when you're talking enforcement, you don't tend to talk to people who are trying to build out innovation and investment as a thesis. That's one of the challenges that we face locally that I think many jurisdictions do. That, you know, it's water and oil often when it comes to those conversations. And I'm of the firm view that the jurisdictions that move forward well and relatively quickly are willing to have what are very difficult conversations. We should be able to say enforcement is a priority without saying it'll come at the expense of all sort of investment and capital formation. So that's a tricky thing though, because of the way people silo conversations.
Yeah, and again, enforcement that doesn't create or obfuscate kind of operational certainty. I think that's the key in the US, for instance. There is just this opacity around what is industry permitted to do, or what enforcement might follow because of the lack of clarity for this particular industry. And the fear that I would have is other jurisdictions that have an aggressive or a motivated, I should say, enforcement toolbox, but don't have those guardrails, could fall into that same trap. And so that's always the plight of not having that clarity, which is why we're so motivated to work constructively with the likes of Treasury and others to be able to move the ball forward.
Yeah, and the reality now is, particularly in APAC, and I'm spending a lot of time getting a sense of other jurisdictions and then trying to find the conversations in. The challenge we all face, and I've seen this a lot out of Singapore, because a lot of businesses are domiciled in Singapore when they have a global presence. You start in Singapore and you go everywhere else. I think we mentioned before we started recording, Katie, some of the time you're 85% right, but you miss the 15% that ultimately determines how an ecosystem will move forward or not. And we do the same thing. Australia will offer a view about what we think is happening in APAC, and ASEAN countries will offer views about what's happening in Australia. They're largely right, but you really do need a sort of a more granular view. You need boots on the ground. And I've said this to businesses a lot when they're thinking about the foray. I said, there's no point trying to tell us from afar what you think is important, because there are enough people here trying to tell us. So you just don't get that cut through. So that appreciation, I think, has been not where it should be. But I think as the more we talk about this being a global technology, and the reality for governments around the world is they recognize it, Katie. I get the sense everyone's pretty scared about losing controls of all sorts of things that they're used to geography protecting them from. Australia is removed from many other jurisdictions. Geography serves us as well as sometimes it hinders us. Whereas this technology is global first. It's data packets. So from that perspective, the question is, you know, do we want to play a meaningful role in intersecting our respective jurisdictions? Again, a complicated conversation for countries to be having.
Yeah, absolutely. So I wanted to finish with a bit of a call to action. If you were in front of your favorite Polly's there or or in the rooms where it happened, we talked a lot about policy in this conversation, but as you also alluded to, there are lots of elements or ingredients that cultivate any market as a hub for innovation. And while there might not be that political motivation currently for Australia to be the hub for blockchain, crypto, Web3, what have you, if you were to kind of lay out the case and what ingredients are crucial for Australia to seize that opportunity, what would you say?
If there's no time, Katie, because there's two answers here. If you don't have time, then the best way I find you can shortcut these conversations is you create conversations where there's obvious adjacency. You put people next to whoever you're trying to convince who are familiar to them, who have a view that is slightly different from their own. So without the benefit of being able to educate people or provide them resources or get them to carve off a part of their day they otherwise don't have time for, the best thing is to say, here is what your peers are doing, or here are businesses reflective of organisations that exist within Australia, here's what they're doing. And a good example at the moment is conversations that are now escalating around things like the tokenisation of real-world assets. Australia's conservatism because of a lot of its policies with respect to your banking and the like. So it's kind of bring the bigger version of Australian banks into the conversation to make the point that they're looking at it. So that sort of makes things familiar. That's much more likely to dislodge sort of persistent views versus, again, what historically been the case where someone says, this is better, you should just adopt it because it's better. This says it's not necessarily better, it's not necessarily worse, but people are giving it consideration. So not trying to run before you can walk.
Yeah, no, that makes good sense. I think that much like we've seen a lot of innovation out of government in Australia, as well as other APAC markets, we've also seen incumbent industry start to take on some of that that good innovative work. And I hope that that will continue along the venue of digital assets. The work on stablecoin, for instance, was really encouraging, and to see both government as well as some of the existing players in industry decide that they're going to invest time and resource to better understand this technology in a trial period. That's always, I think, an optimistic outcome for anything innovative.
And I think, Katie, this is the reality of rooms I'm in. You know, when I'm standing in front of people, I tell them all the time, imposter syndrome is a thing in this space. If you have not committed time to it, it's hard to understand it. If you've read a headline, it's hard to understand. And lots of people, you know, for fear of embarrassing themselves or for fear of not feeling like they're across their remit, and this is a challenge of a lot of C-suite executives, if you walk into a big business and ask them what they think, they can't tell you, they haven't turned their attention to it and they don't know. So they have to give you a view. And if you haven't spent a lot of time in this space, your view will be very vanilla. Your view will be very driven by headline-driven themes. People will just say, regulatory uncertainty, lots of scams, let's move on. That's something which people need to acknowledge, that it's very difficult to develop expertise in this space, but someone needs to within the organization. So that's always the prod and the poke for me.
Yeah. So my takeaway from this conversation in terms of the state of affairs down under is that we are not necessarily at the starting line, because you've done an amazing job laying a great foundation, but we have a lot of work ahead of us in this race towards understanding the benefit and the value of digital assets to the Australian market, compelling policymakers, lawmakers, and regulators toward creating that regulatory clarity, and in particular, in aligning perhaps better with the political agenda. So there's a meeting of those incentives there that industry and with the help of you, Steve, and others can begin to illuminate for government.
There's one other silver lining here, Katie, is everyone's more tightly bunched than they think. Most people think that people have really broken away and it's going to be very difficult to catch up. My experience has been you can do less than you think and be relevant. And that's kind of the thing, again, I give confidence to people about. So just talking about something engenders interest, you know, speaking in a public environment engenders interest, you can do very little. So I don't think anyone's really fallen off the back so badly, save for really obvious decisions where you say we're banning everything. Everyone else is close enough to be able to play a meaningful role here. So that's, again, some of the things I try to give people confidence around is you don't have to worry about betting all of your reputation or resources in order to have some traction here. Just creep forward a little bit. So that's something people can take away.
Oh, we like a good silver lining to end with. I'm so grateful for your time, Steve. I'm blessed to have Steve coming to Singapore soon as he commences his world tour 2.0. So really, really lucky to catch you while you were in Australia. And thank you so much for your insights today. Really appreciate it.
Pleasure. Thanks, Kate.
All right, folks, thank you so much for checking out this episode of the Worldview podcast. I've included some links in the show notes, so be sure to check those out. The next edition of the Worldview Substack will be coming out soon, so do subscribe with your email if you're keen for a weekly treat in your inbox. If you enjoyed this podcast episode, subscribe to follow along where you listen to podcasts. And do send me some feedback as we continue to tour the globe with more fabulous guests. Until then, stay curious about the world, stay optimistic about the future, and see you back here on The Worldview soon.